ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to another Monday and the ABC Cricket Podcast. I'm Ed Cowan. I'm joined again by my mate, General Manager of the Sydney Thunder, cricket analyst and all-round legend, Trent Copeland. Copes, you did such a great job 2 weeks ago, we decided have to have you back. So welcome back.
Unbelievable. I've got another start, Ted, but I'm happy to be here. And there's lots going on in the cricket world, including an ODI series, a World Cup going on the other side of the world. And the Aussies are playing good cricket wherever they are.
That's true. And less than a month to the Ashes, we've got some topics to pick off. That's for sure. Got some great feedback. I mean, as you probably know by now, LinkedIn all of a sudden has become the social media giant for cricket podcasters. That's where everyone gets in touch. So everyone loved your views on the fast bowlers, Cummins, etc. in the last episode. So hopefully you're on form today. Are you going to bring the energy?
I'll bring the A game, Ted. You've set a wonderful rundown in your infinite wisdom. So I'll run with you, mate. And I'm going to poke some questions back at you today.
Yeah,
I ran sidekick last time. I'm coming back at you with a few today. It's good.
Okay, well, I think we should kick off with the Indian series wrapped up in Sydney on Saturday night. Both of us were there, so maybe we can work backwards and start with that game specifically and kind of zoom out from there. I mean, there are a couple of things that I loved about Saturday night, a couple of things, my views on ODI cricket more broadly, but to see basically 50,000 people in October packed into the SCG cheering on their team, India, was a great experience. I love that the wicket had pace and bounce in it. You know, for too long, the SCG has been, either low and slow or variable bounce. It felt like, and maybe it has to do with the Swans kind of bowing out of the AFL quickly, but the SCG was absolutely immaculate, full house. There was lots to love.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Ted. I was out in the middle prior to the match and looking at the surface, but also when I say the surface, the outfield I've never seen in such pristine condition in October. For a cricket summer, the change of grass on the square as well. Now, I'm no curator, but it's the first time they've had the proper crack at getting the square how they want it to be. It probably is a shame eventually that it's not going to have the same characteristics right to the core of the old SCG, like the break-up, the other wickets on the square being really abrasive for reverse swing and those things. But I said exactly the same thing when we were out there, because a lot of people, some of the players, talking about, oh, geez, it's going to do a bit today. But what I saw was a rock-hard surface. Yeah. The live grass was what provided KL Rahul in the first 10 overs of the game, standing on the circle and catching them at head height. That stuff to me is great for the bowlers in the first 10 overs where there's a bit of lateral movement. But after that, it's batters can trust the surface. They can hit through the line. And when they get themselves in like Rohit and Virat did, it's bloody hard to stop them.
Yeah, it was amazing to see, Harshit Rana, who's not known for his speed. He's fast medium at best. The ball was flying through in that Australian innings. I mean, it's interesting just to kind of dig a layer deeper here. You and I both think of the SCG as, that traditional spinner's wicket that breaks up. But if you actually go through the backlogs of notes that the grounds keeper has kept over, more than a century there, and there is this great notebook, that traditionally the SCG was actually a hard and fast wicket that flew through, and it was probably not until the 80s that that we remember the New South Wales teams, playing three spinners in the ball, turning from day two in a shield game. So they've relayed the square. They're trying to grow a different version of the Santa Ana grass, and it's taken a couple of years for those roots to kind of grow properly, and I'm loving what I'm seeing. We saw a far better test match, I thought, last test at the SCG, and for a wicket that I think has copped some criticism, and rightly so. It feels like it's back to its best.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And then let's go to the outside of the actual cricket field and what we saw from the Indian fans. That was like, it's one of those nights where it reminded me of the Pakistan India semi-final at the World Cup. I don't know if you were there that night as well, but it was, I'm sure
It's
the MCG
electric.
was the same. It is just a different type of fanatical behavior in the crowd when Virat Kohli in the fielding innings. That backward point takes, a little dive to his left, and the whole crowd roars. It is just different than what we are used to and so often see in this country. But it was magical to be there. And then that Indian innings, Ed, that was, a sight to behold when you saw the first wicket of Shubman Gill go down, and everyone was standing and watching Virat walk to the crease. It felt like one of those moments in time. That you're going to reference that you were there for that. And it was a really cool place to be.
Yeah, I think that's probably where my mind went. Is it was a moment in history. It was Sharma and Kohli's last ever game in Australia. Two guys that Australia's really embraced, as foes, but also as friends as well, in terms of what they've brought to the game here in Australia. So it did feel like it was an honour to be there. I haven't seen an atmosphere like that at the SCG since the 2015 World Cup when Australia played India and Steve Smith put on that batting clinic. But the thing that came to mind on the flip side was, if India aren't playing, there are, I don't know, 5,000 people there perhaps, and so we can't play India every year in ODI cricket and rely on 90% of the stadium to be Indian fans. So to me, it felt like it was a little bit of a made for television moment, if you will. It was a honour to be there, but it was a dead rubber. It was almost made for this fairy tale of a fantastic Sharma 100, and Kohli obviously played well as well, but it lacked that intensity. It was great entertainment, but it didn't feel to me like it was ODI cricket at its absolute best.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think the Aussies having wrapped up the series and the rotation that went throughout the series of the Aussies and some guys ducking back to Shield cricket to prioritise Ashes stuff and injuries that have happened that were unforeseen in the lead up as well to Abbott and others, it did make for a bit of a clunky series. And we're sitting there thinking about okay, who is the player of the series during the match, and it was. Almost impossible until Rohit scored 100. It was impossible to pick a player of the series because of exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, if we look at the series in its totality, the Australians played very well, I thought, in Adelaide, and we can pick that apart, and then rain affected in Perth. So it's kind of tricky in these three match series. I personally would have probably preferred to see seven T20 games played. It's a bit weird, this whole white ball tour setup, but I like that it is a great entree to a test series, and it's found its place a little bit in the summer, leading into the test summer to play some white ball cricket. I personally think, ODI cricket should be killed. And so with that in mind and a bias, it was nice to start seeing a few new faces, and it kind of lends itself to a conversation around what does the Australian ODI team look like? So we're 2 and a bit years out from a World Cup, 2027, I think November, in Africa. We've had the retirement of Maxwell, Smith, Stoinis. So 2 years out, the Aussies really need to find a team, and we saw the emergence of Matt Short and Cooper Connolly and Mitch Owen. So and Matt Renshaw. So we had some debutants in there, a few people in different places. Matt Short had previously, been seen to be an opener and, for Australia in shorter form cricket, and coming in that middle order role. So what caught your eye from a team composition point of view?
Yeah, the same things caught my eye in that it was great to see. I think the biggest standout in the entire three game series was Cooper Connolly getting Australia over the line in Adelaide. So that run chase, under pressure, a young kid that we all know. He's now debuted in all three formats for Australia. He's played a test in subcontinent conditions. He's played an ODI series against an Indian team, no matter the context, that carries aura and has sort of that enormity to it. And that innings where he really did bat with the tail and orchestrate the chase for the last, at least the last 30 runs, if not longer. That to me is what, if I'm George Bailey and Andrew McDonald and Dodders and numerous others, that's what I'm looking for in guys. It's not necessarily scoring 300s on the trot. But then I'll go to my second point, Ed. And many people are talking about Matt Short playing well. And is this the time that he solidifies himself at number three? Well, 74 in that game was really good, but 110 red, and then we're talking. That's the disappointing nature of Matt Short's three games is he had a really good tournament or series, but there was nothing that goes stamp on that spot. You've got to find me in 2027 in that Australian lineup. And just to add to it, I was thinking about what is our team come the start of the World Cup or in our biggest game at the World Cup. As a reference point, Ted, let's go back to 2023, the final. It was Head, Warner, Finch, Smith, Marnus, Maxwell, Inglis, Cummins, Stark, Hazelwood, Zampa. Now, Finch gone, Warner gone, Smith gone, Maxwell gone, Stoinis just outside that gone as well. There's a few spots to fill, and when we're talking about these new guys like Mitch Owen and Connolly, and Matt Short and the like, even Matty Renshaw, who I thought was impressive. When you map it against that, there's a lot of spots. But then I've gone in and actually thought about, okay, what would the team actually be? And man, the guys that didn't play in this series, Cameron Green's a lock if he's playing and bowling. Alex Carey didn't play in that team, but will be in. Josh Inglis wasn't playing in this series, but will be in. And I think Marnus, in the current form that he's in, is going to absolutely be batting at three in that team. So it's a really interesting one, but great exposure to some of those young guys, as you said.
We spend way too much time together, and I actually don't see that often. But maybe over the past, because I'm pretty aligned in that. I think this was a great series to get some game time into a few people that probably aren't in your best 11, so to speak, just to see what they've got. Cooper Conley, every time I see him bat, I just think Sean Marsh, and that's probably not a name that people, resonate with. A great Australian cricketer, but you and I both know he was probably the most talented player of our generation. He had a great international career and a fine cricketer, but not in the echelon of a Steve Smith or a Dave Warner. But probably it was there for him as a 21-year-old, some injuries, some misfortune, as is the way when you're a top order batter. But Cooper Connolly played this cover drive. I don't know. He took him from maybe 4 to 8 in Adelaide, and he just timed the absolute pants off, and it went like a tracer bullet out to the boundary of the Adelaide Oval. And I thought, oh, when you see shots like that, it was a proper cricket shot. And this is a guy that came in. I think he'd scored 10 runs in 7 games or something. Under immense pressure to not just show that he should be selected, but that he should be even in and around the hoop of being selected. And he came out and won the game single-handedly, even how he managed to bat with the tail on Saturday night in Sydney. So I love what I see. He's a three-prong player, much as Matt Short, but I actually think they're probably vying for one spot in that World Cup squad, someone that can bowl some spin, field the house down and play that middle order role. Personally don't love Short batting at three. I think that should be, where your best player bats. And in this current setup with no Steve Smith, I think that belongs to Marnus Labuschagne or Josh Inglis. So you're right. I think there's one spot for that type of player. I like the Mitch Owen style player, the Tim David not playing 50 over cricket, but someone who can come in 7 to 10 overs and ice an innings and isn't expected to necessarily win a game. If the team's in trouble, but can win games off their bat with 10 overs to play. I'm not so sure about his batting with more than that. We saw the other night him when the ball was flying through, it wasn't all that comfortable for him. So he's a rare talent. The way he played in Adelaide as well caught my eye. I actually think the biggest plus of the series was Josh Hazlewood. I know, that
Oh
sounds
man.
a little ridiculous, but it as a Australian Test cricket fan, if you just watched his, I don't know, what was it, 100 balls that he bowled during this series, you were licking your lips thinking, good luck. Because if the wickets are flying through, like they did in Adelaide, Sydney, and Perth in these one days, that England top order have some real problems. They are going to have a lot of questions thrown at them.
Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth. One of the things that I saw in his warm up at the SCG on the weekend, but then he bowled from the commentary end during that first spell. And when Josh Hazlewood has that amount of lift out of the surface, plus a little away swing just before the ball bounces to a right-hander, it's just that it's sort of unquantifiable eliteness that he has. It's really difficult to say, yeah, many other bowlers do it. Many other bowlers bowl outswing. Many other bowlers have nice bounce out of the surface. But he, since the age of 17, has just had this unique nature about him that when he is bowling like that, no one can deal with it. Many will score runs, many will find ways for different periods. But if he plays five tests and he's bowling like he bowled in this, he went none for in Adelaide as well. And it was one of the better spells I've ever seen him bowl.
I mean, I think
Nuts.
it was described as the greatest none forever taken.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Yeah. And I think the team's really well set up. I think one guy that would have been a little disappointed was Nathan Ellis. I was really keen in the absence of Pat Cummins that he sort of, stamped the authority on his spot. And he will still have that spot when any of those big three quicks don't play. But
2 years is a
that's an
long time,
interesting.
though, as a fast bowler in any format, let alone a format that I think they only play 12 games in the next 14 months. So
Yeah.
it's now the poor cousin in terms of we've got a World Cup T20 around the corner, and then another year and a bit onto the 50 over version. So I mean, Ellis we know is at his best, a fantastic white ball bowler. It was off the mark the other night at the SCG. I guess my only concern is, does he get leapfrogged by, Spencer Johnson or someone who the selectors feel can provide a little bit more spark with the new ball? If Mitch Stark and the like aren't playing, but I think they need his death bowling, certainly in T20 cricket, and it, 50 over cricket, it feels like it's a bit more of a toss of the coin.
Yeah, and so T20 is great distinction there. I reckon that, Mitch Stark having retired, I think he's a lock in that team. But then you go to who has jumped out of the pack and done really well in the last 3 months. And the guys outside of Nathan Ellis, who I think is a lock for the World Cup squad, I think Ben Dwarcius has been exceptional and has really done well when given opportunity. And that new ball X factor with the left arm, but also great skills that he's honed over many years during the middle phases at the SCG.
Yeah, and that's
And Xavier Bartlett as well.
Bartlett. I'm a
Yeah.
big I'm on the Bartlett
Man, I'm
train.
a fan.
I think he's
Yeah.
excellent.
Yeah. And I think at any stage, last time I was on with you, Ted, I'm becoming more and more confident that he might be the guy, the Johnny on the spot, right time, right place, bowling well, between Sean Abbott and Xavier Bartlett. Whoever gets a gig during an Ashes, I'm sure would be pumped for it. But Bartlett looks primed. He's bowling so well.
One other thing that caught my eye, we love a random piece of trivia on this podcast. So I'm sure on your broadcast, you probably picked this up as well. India have lost 18 tosses in a row in ODI
Yeah.
cricket. 18, not, oh, that's a bit of bad luck. Like mathematically, what is it? One, it's 1 divided by 2 to the power of 18 gets you to, I don't know, 1 in 250,000 or something like that. That is an obscene bad run with the coin.
Mate, I'm sure you encountered this in your club cricket days, but the
That's a
moment
whole
you
season
lose
of club
three,
cricket. That's not
yeah,
winning a tournament.
The moment you lose three on the trot, it'll certainly in my experience, you're looking around the change room trying to get a proxy. Yeah, anyone chance to go out there and do this for me? The one question I did have was, I wonder if he's calling the same at home. He's just tossing the coin, right? But
Yeah.
away from home, if during the three match series he's gone heads, tails, heads, and then lost, that's worse. He'd be Jizzy be in the bush.
I mean, just taking it up a step. What's your view of ODI cricket and its place in the landscape? The calendar's getting squeezed badly. You love Test cricket as much as I love Test cricket. It just feels like it's slowly drifting away, and no one really has the courage to kind of nip it in the bud.
I've got a pretty firm view on this all the way down through our pathways, if I'm being honest, Ted. And I'm certainly speaking personally here, not in reference to anyone else's views. But our game in this country has been built on white ball cricket generally, and training skills, but largely aimed at 50 over cricket, and then test match or red ball cricket and 2 day cricket in, say, Premier Cricket up. And we have become more and more sort of, let's do that plus add a bit, do that plus add a bit in terms of T20 expertise or death bowling in white ball cricket, range hitting, things like that are becoming more common. My view, and this goes into your overarching question, is that that doesn't service the actual needs anymore. You cannot be elite at all three formats of the game without doing dedicated, specific T20 training from a young age. You can be great at it, but you won't ever reach the pinnacle, is my view. My ultimate view, Ted, is that I think there's a shift coming, and those that are able to jump ahead of it will have a competitive advantage. But my view is red ball training and T20 training still service 50 over cricket. The other way around does not service T20. So that's my view, is that both games played in bilateral series, selections for 50 over World Cups can come via T20 cricket, in my opinion. Still played domestically, potentially, but that's my view. And I think it's coming. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah, and it's still obviously a great money spinner for the game, but I think increasingly there's other ways to find that revenue. It was interesting to see just in terms of how it's been deprioritized domestically. That was Matt Renshaw's first ever List Day game at the SCG. So how
Oh, there you
we can
go.
ever imagine and it was the first. I think List A cricket hasn't been played at the SCG in 12 seasons. So there's a whole generation of cricketers that, play on out grounds, not at night time. There's obviously the Big Bash in and around that, but batting for 30 overs under lights very different to chasing at the last moment for five for someone like Matt Renshaw. So yeah, I mean, my personal view is still pretty firm. I think Australia should take a lead here and not play any 50 over cricket in their domestic summer. By all means, if there's bilateral series that need to be played to fulfill obligations, do so. But it's we should be the ones to show some leadership and put a bit of a line in the sand. But we'll move on because the Ashes is less than a month away. And there's lots of talking points. Cummins officially ruled out today. Steve Smith officially made captain until Cummins comes back. So no real new news there. Things that caught my attention this week was, under the debate of who's going to open the batting, and we can come to if your team's changed or not. When Steve Smith, on his return from New York, was asked about Sam Constance, there was. I don't know, it caught my ear. He said, my door's always open, my phone's always on if he ever wants to talk batting. So I took from that that Sam Constance isn't talking batting with Steve Smith at all, as opposed to the Marnus Labuschagne approach in the back pocket, can't get rid of me. Sam's off, running his own race and doing his own thing in terms of how he wants to play. So I don't know if you caught that or had any views on Steve Smith's comments.
Yeah, I probably didn't take that out of that comment, but now that you play it back like that, it probably makes sense. I'm sure you were the same in your career, Ted, that there's guys that you other than him being potentially one of the greatest ever, if not the greatest ever, the personality elements of spending time together and hitting balls together and living in each other's pockets, Marnus and Steve are quite natural in that aspect, as opposed to Sam and Steve potentially not, albeit they're both
Play for the
Sutherland
same club.
cricketers and yeah, have the
They could be at
opportunity when
Caringbah Oval throwing balls to each other.
albeit Steve is in New York, not Caringbah, most of the time. But it's one of those things where I reckon Sam probably needs some time where he just bunkers down and figures things out. But there is also a time where giving a guy a call that's done it all, and can offer some advice, or even if you do just come in and hit balls with Steve Smith in this next month. And even this goes, a lot of people just think so much about that first test squad. And if he's not in it, then he's ostracized. But like there's a greater holistic development opportunity here. And part of that is mental, and part of that is the challenge on speculation and how am I going, or I miss out in Perth. Does that make me a bad player, or am I still going okay? But the other is spending time with the likes of Stark and Cummins from a teammate sense and leadership, but also then Smith on just holistic, how do you go about scoring runs, like building an innings, choices, when to hit, gear one versus when to hit the ramp and things like that, that can only be really done over time and with mates off the field.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And you kind of picked on something that I was gonna kind of dig here. Is, we've kind of moved away from players being the best coaches of other players. Sam's got his own private batting coach who, has helped him dramatically to this point in time. But the best coach that he could probably have over the next 4 weeks is Steve Smith, That's not picking his brains over coffee. That's getting down and dirty in the nets, talking technique, talking about the craft of scoring runs in different situations, and if different bowlers are doing different things, how can you negate that? What tactics are you bringing in? Are you changing your guard? Are you batting out of your crease? Are you looking to leave more? And those conversations promote a really deep learning environment because he needs to accelerate his learning from what I'm seeing so far this season. There's nothing technically wrong, though everyone has little weaknesses that you got to try and paper over, but it's the art of scoring runs that Steve Smith has absolutely mastered in all conditions around the world. And there are few Australian batters and very few global batters that have been able to do that with different techniques and different tactics. And he's been so malleable, I would be in his pocket, irrespective of whether your personalities are the same and you love hitting balls, you don't love hitting balls. Ultimately, you are there to be the best player you can be, and there's no one better to learn off. So that's probably a nice little segue into two topics. One is a look forward to the Shield games ahead, the last Shield games before selection happens, I think. And, secondly, the topic is if Trent Copeland selector of the Australian cricket team, what would that team look like? So you can pick one of those two to start with.
I'll start with the Shield watch, because I'm interested in your perspective on if there's anyone that I'm not thinking about that you are. But undoubtedly, I think there's a big watch on the two all-rounders that haven't played much or bowled much, if at all, in Cam Green, where we've heard out of the Australian selectors' mouths that it was a very precautionary approach and that he's okay. And whether he's going to bowl at all in a match and prior to that first test match in Cameron Green. The other one, Beau Webster, in the match against the Vics at the Junction. Can't imagine he's on the plane and pumped about bowling his seamers at the Junction. But,
If they roll out the wicket they rolled out last week, I reckon he's
That's true.
absolutely he's flying himself there, thinking this is going to be an absolute just present the seam in any condition, and I've got five in the pocket.
I certainly didn't play on one of those at Junction. Anyway, the other one is, Queensland versus New South Wales at the Gabba is going to be one of those Shield matches where you think there's a lot of guys there that are in full on either test prep mode and are going to hopefully churn out some massive hundreds. And in Nathan Lyon and others' case, pump out some really good work with the ball. But then you've got, I think, also Usman Khawaja needing some runs, as well as Sam Constance, and at a very prominent test venue against a good attack. How does he aim up in that match as well? So they're the ones that I'm specifically looking at, but there's a few outside of that realm that obviously have some bowling work to do to get in, ahead of the pack
Yeah.
in the absence of Cummins. And then if that prolongs, if anyone else of those quicks goes down.
Yeah, we can kind of merge these two topics because you're right in a sense. Bo Webster has done no bowling, and from all reports, his ankle is good. He wanted to actually play in the last game, and the Australian cricket team medical staff basically put a line through him. So I think he's ready to go. I get very worried when Cam Green, has side stiffness, having not done a heap of bowling, and you can now, I think, almost assume that he's not going to be fully fit to bowl for the Ashes in terms of he'll be bowling, but he won't be doing huge amount of bulk overs. Maybe it's 10 an innings. Let's kind of think in those brackets, 10 to 12 an innings. And if that's the case, they're probably going to need Webster as backup, and that starts formulating your view whether there's another spot to open the batting or not. And if that case, it's Marnus plays, the two all-rounders play, but there's a world, of course, where if Cam Green is fully fit, I think it's a bit more of a shootout between Webster and Green in terms of who bats at six. Because I've been thinking about this a lot. You're hard pressed to argue that Marnus, in the form he's in, is a world-class player. You bat him in the spot that he has had the most international success, and that's at three. And it really does kind of, all of a sudden, Labuschagne Smith Head starts turning a few heads in the England camp, because they don't want that. They want Marnus at one, and Green and Webster, I think. And so, if that's the case, it opens up a spot for a Weatherald or a Constance to partner Usman. But you're right, the other thing that you said that I think has gone under the radar is Usman would be dying for some runs. He got 150 in that run fest in round one. He's not moving as well as he probably would like leading into a test series, but in his mind, whatever out he'll be judged by the output he puts on the board in those first couple of tests. But we can only hope that he's firing, because those tests are going to decide the series, no doubt. Historically, what is it? Probably there's 12 days of cricket before Christmas, and those 12 days will determine the series. They ain't going five, and so we need Usman scoring some runs to let the middle order go to work. So I think you're right on that watch. I think Weatherall slightly ahead of Constance at this stage, but that is a big asterisk on the basis that, I think as I alluded to, the selection of a spare opening batter is more predicated on Cam Green's body than anything else.
Yeah, and look, I think there's many machinations here that I consider. I reckon I blabbered on a bit on the first pod I was on with you about, categories of players and the role in the team and the type of player they are, those types of things. Just different format, but on the weekend we saw Mitch Owen have to go out to bat at seven in the Australian lineup in that ODI with Mitch Stark at eight. And immediately there was a sense in my mind that. And this is not a reflection on Starkey, it's more just what Cummins brings to batting at eight. That Mitch Owen needed to not play his natural game and needed to bat for a few overs before he could then bat properly. He then got out pretty quickly, but that number six, seven, eight in this test team is so crucial to prolonged success over a five-test Ashes series. And then in reverse, in the bowling context, when you've got Webster and Green both not overly healthy and having big workloads, I see no scenario where they can go in with only one of those guys plus the four bowlers. So I think we're getting into a scenario where Green and Webster, in my view, have to play, and should play in the context that they both put up good performances. But I think it's going to be push come to shove. You're asking me what's my team today? It's Marnus opening, and I think Green and Webster in the lineup, along with the three quicks and Nathan Lyon. So, a little bit of an eye on best performed at the Wacker, at Optus Stadium, but then also not leaving anyone vulnerable in that lineup from a bowling context to miss other games during the series as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty firmly on that train. I'd also love Steve Smith to bat three and Cameron Green four, but I don't think I'm gonna get my wish, and unfortunately. What's your wider reflections, in the lead up? It feels like England are playing some form of emotional terrorism, on all fronts, dropping all kinds of verbal spars from ex-players, the usual Ashes kind of lead up in many respects, but they do have a team with lots of match winners, but not many who've won matches down here, and so there is some unknowns. They've only won four tests in Australia since 2000, so they are coming in as rank outsiders, and yet here we are, kind of casting these. Kind of mythical views that maybe they could win. So keen to get your view. I mean, I'm pretty firm on my views that Australia's going to win 3-1. I think England will have moments that they can unpick the Australian team if they're a bit more methodical, but they'll do something stupid like they did in the previous series, like declare before the end of day one and let Australia back into a test match, or who knows what we're going to get, but I'm keen to get your views.
Yeah, and I think equally silly was the moment when Nathan Lyon had gone down, and they were mid batting innings when Nathan Lyon goes down in the middle of an Ashes series and chose to accelerate, lose wickets, and not put any physical pressure on our quicks during that time, and then go on and unsurprisingly, they played better throughout the series. But imagine if Stark and Hazelwood and Cummins were all absolutely physically cooked just because they put a bit of a hold on the on the sort of overarching baseball mentality and just chose to tactically play the physical game. So those type of things, I'm fascinated to see if they have that geared approach to their game when they come out here. And certainly, when you listen to Brendan McCullum's conferences that he's been speaking at, or when he's been asked about things in interviews, he has walked it back a little, that it is all out aggression. He's talking about smarts and things like that. So fascinated to see that play out. I think, Ted, we're going to see 4-1 Australia. I'm going to not forecast a draw. I don't think a draw will happen unless there's rain, and let's not predict
Rain in
that.
Sydney. Rain in Sydney. Guaranteed. Guaranteed rain in Sydney.
But I do think this is as solidified as an England batting lineup has been for quite some time. And their only real choice coming in is whether it's Bethell or Pope in that lineup. But the big difference really is the spin quality and the ability for a spinner to have genuine impact out here. I'm not convinced Bashir can do that. And their quicks, albeit individually, they all have talent. They all have some really good stuff that they've done at test level. Atkinson and Cass and Jofra is a standout, obviously, but put it all together and they don't have the group that we have in the bowling unit, and particularly the spin threat that we have in Nathan Lyon. So that's where I think the difference is going to be.
Yeah, I also think that there's going to be a big difference in catching behind the wicket. I think if Australia are going to get, I don't know, 15 chances an inning, so if they can take 10 of those, pretty abruptly, I'm predicting the Australian quicks to run rampant. Maybe this is a bit off script, but if you had the new ball in your hand, maybe you can just go through a few little things that would catch your eye in terms of how you'd be thinking about getting out, a Duckett or a Brook, guys that haven't played here before. How would you look to work them over?
Well, I mean, my mind goes immediately back to how Australia started the Ashes series away in England. Remember, the deep point was out from ball one. Now, I don't foresee that happening anymore. I think Australia have got to the point where now they're comfortable, particularly in Australian conditions. I think very comfortable with Zach Crawley trying to hit the first ball on the up through cover for four, and Ben Duckett trying to hit every ball off middle stump and outside through backward point. I think they're both exceptional players, but my thoughts and my observations would be that I would trust that my good stuff, and in the Aussie bowling group's context, that my good stuff would be good enough if I stick there for long enough in Australian conditions. So
Yeah,
the challenge will be, sorry, just on Harry Brook, is when tempo shifts and Harry Brook and Ben Stokes are batting together at 120 strike rate, what's our avenues to getting that back? In England, you can't, but here there'll be bouncer plans, there'll be different things with big boundaries that those guys just aren't exposed to as much. So I think you'll see a lot of that. Round the wicket, three guys out, short leg, when they're
right,
in
square
their
leg.
up tempo type.
Yeah, I agree. It's far easier to control the scoreboard in Australia. Bigger grounds, faster wickets. It does bring the short stuff in harder to hit it out of the ground at the MCG, 120 meters to clear the fence. Probably only 65 to clear the rope. But you get the idea. Pretty abruptly. I'd back you with a new ball against Ben Duckett. I think fourth slip would be warming their hands up pretty quickly. And he's someone that you saw a lot at Northamptonshire, I'm sure as well. So we'll keep. We might dive into that next week. A little bit more of a technical breakdown. Copes, there's a few more things on the docket, but we'll roll a few of them over. But there is one big topic to get to quickly, and that's there is a massive Women's World Cup going on. Since the last time we spoke, Australia's still undefeated. Two very different wins. One, a back against the wall, four for nothing, chasing a good total against England to have Annabel Sutherland and the like come through in the middle order, and then against South Africa the other night, Alana King, 7 for 18, spun a web, absolutely gave him a touch up. So Australia to play India, England to play South Africa. What are you making of the World Cup? And the only thing on my mind from here is when Australia's playing so well, you almost get closer to a slip up, and you want to be playing your best cricket at the back end of the tournament, and they could not be playing any better than they have in the first, seven qualifying games.
I'll say this. I think they've had their slip ups. 7 for 70 against Pakistan and winning that game to me is a slip up, even though they did win and Beth Mooney pulled them out of the fire. They have had a couple of slip ups, but playing India in front of a packed crowd and their batting group, India's batting group, playing so well, they definitely have the upside to beat us. What I will say is, I have been so impressed, and amongst male, female World Cups performances, I haven't really seen a group of players at their peak this often for a long time in any World Cup that I've seen. You just mentioned Annabel Sutherland. Ash Gardner, I don't think I've ever seen her in better form, and she's barely taken a wicket so far. But her batting and the consistency to score 200s in this tournament, we haven't even really mentioned Elise Perry. Phoebe Litchfield's had some really good starts and a really good 70 in one of those games, but not gone on and scored a big one. Elisa Healy, to me, is the thing I'm watching. Didn't play in the last two games with that little dummy half that she's done. Hopefully that's okay, because if she is playing, this group is so good. And there are no holes. There's batting all the way down to number nine. And Alana King's bowling might be the best leg spin in the world right now, male or female. She is bowling so well. It is just ridiculous. She doesn't bowl a bad ball.
No, she's got it on a dime, and turning it as well, which in one day cricket is such a threat. You can if you're beating edges of the bat, even if they are hitting it, the chance of a mishit skewing off the outer edge is pretty high. So yeah, this is a team that I think, if anything, only ever competing against complacency, and none of that has crept in to date. This is a team absolutely at the peak of their powers, but they still have two games to ice the cake. No one will remember if they, play amazing cricket and finish second or third. Fingers crossed that doesn't happen. So we'll know by the next episode. So they play on the 30th. We'll know definitely who the finalists are, and we can cover that game. But Copes, what a treat. Thank you so much. We've got a bit more to cover next week. You're back, and then Corbin will be back from his little vacay. But thankfully, we've got you for another hour next week. But absolute treat. Thank you.
No worries, and feel free to bring those LinkedIn questions and anything else anyone's got if you're willing to put it on air, Ted. But good fun as always. So much going on in the cricket world. Always happy to dissect it with you. Good on you, mate.
ABC Listen, podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.